From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In October 1993, a nation watched. The unthinkable happened.
We're hit!
X-1 is going down.
Now, witness the courage.
Get him out of there.
RPG!
The world never saw.
Where do you think you're going?
With you guys.
Not that cast on your nut.
Black Hawk Down.
Black Hawk Down. Hollywood joins forces with the Pentagon to transform the 1993 invasion of Somalia from the U.S. military's darkest hour to its brightest. Columbia University tries to restrict a student counter-summit during the World Economic Forum. And a look at Reading Between the Lines, the New Education Law, a Victory for Bush and His Corporate Allies. We'll look at McGraw-Hill. All that and more coming. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Less than 24 hours after Yasser Arafat's ministers called on all Palestinian organizations to stop targeting Israeli civilians, a woman detonated explosives in Jerusalem yesterday, killing herself and another person. The blast went off half a block from where a Palestinian gunman shot dead two Israeli women last Tuesday. Palestinian sources identified her as Shanaz al-Amouri, a 20-year-old student at Nablus University on the West Bank. It's the first time in the 9-year history of Palestinian suicide attacks that a woman has carried out a suicide bombing. Israel's responded to recent Palestinian attacks by assassinating militants and using F-16 fighter jets and helicopter gunships to strike symbols of Arafat's authority and his security headquarters. Last night, Israeli officials blamed Arafat failing to crack down on militant groups operating from territory under his control in the West Bank and Gaza. They said the Palestinian leader specifically endorsed violence in a speech Saturday night. But the Palestinian leadership, quote, strongly condemned the suicide attack and called on President George Bush to send Mideast envoy General Anthony Zinni back to the region. 52 Israeli reserve soldiers announced this weekend that they will no longer fight in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, claiming military actions there have nothing to do with security for Israel and are meant to control the Palestinians. In an advertisement in Israeli newspapers, the soldiers said Israel's stringent travel bans, which confine many Palestinians to their communities, needlessly punish the Palestinians. Israel says the closures are needed to prevent attacks by Palestinian militants. The announcement marked the first time since the outbreak of the current round of fighting in September 2000 that a large group of soldiers announced that they have refused to serve in Palestinian areas. Last week, we reported that U.S. forces killed scores of Taliban and al-Qaeda soldiers. Well, Afghans have accused U.S. forces of attacking a school and, in fact, killing people sheltering there in a raid last week that the Pentagon claims targeted Taliban fighters. According to Pentagon accounts, special forces attacked two enemy compounds last Wednesday night at Hazar Khadem, about 60 miles north of Kandahar, and killed about 15 people in a firefight. One U.S. soldier was wounded. 27 prisoners were taken. U.S. officials initially described the target as an al-Qaeda leadership facility, but on Friday said the people there were Taliban fighters. Villagers in Uruzgan province, where the raid took place, said that those killed were neither Taliban nor al-Qaeda fighters, but local people sent to negotiate the surrender of weapons from Taliban in the area. U.S. Special Forces battled al-Qaeda gunmen this morning at a hospital where several fighters had been holed up for nearly 2 months and had threatened to kill anyone who tried to capture them. At least this is what the U.S. military is saying. The U.S. forces moved into the walled Mirwais hospital compound, and two loud explosions and automatic weapons fire rocked the compound as the raid was launched. A much larger explosion was heard more than 5 hours later, and a fire broke out. According to an Army spokesman, the raid was conducted at the request of Afghan authorities. There was no immediate word of casualties. Unclear if any of the al-Qaeda fighters had been captured. Journalists were kept away from the hospital by roadblocks and armed U.S. and Afghan troops, so we cannot confirm whether, in fact, the people inside were al-Qaeda or Taliban fighters. Vice President Dick Cheney and War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday the war captives in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, would not be designated as prisoners of war. Their statements came just hours after Secretary of State General Colin Powell requested a review of how the Geneva Convention might apply to these prisoners' rights. Secretary Powell agrees the captives should not be given a prisoner of war status, but said that he asked the administration to reconsider whether to adhere to the Geneva Convention governing treatment of prisoners in wartime. Cheney said the convention does not apply to those captives because they're not conventional soldiers but terrorists operating outside internationally accepted norms. Officials at the camp told reporters the prisoners were already beginning to organize themselves, with some emerging as leaders. Australian refugee activists taped their mouths shut in protest of the treatment of asylum seekers at rallies across Australia yesterday as detainees continued hunger strikes and attempted suicides at an outback refugee camp. An illegal immigrant who threw himself onto a razor wire fence at the controversial Woomera Detention Center on Saturday was being monitored in the hospital. The detainee tried to escape from the camp, where around 900 immigrants are housed. He was one of 200 asylum seekers who are staging protests at the month. It takes a process, refugee claims. It's the 12th straight day of hunger strikes. Some 35 immigrants still have their mouths sewn shut. Some have tried to hang themselves, and others have swallowed champagne, shampoo and painkillers. But pressure has been mounting on the Conservative Prime Minister, John Howard, who won re-election in November, partly on a tough stand against boat people, to show more compassion for the asylum seekers. A senior government advisor on immigration quit over Australia's hardline treatment of refugees last week, dealing the government an embarrassing blow. Back here, despite mounting pressure on President George Bush's administration to explain the full extent of its dealings with Enron, Vice President Dick Cheney insisted yesterday he would not disclose the full list of industry lobbyists he consulted while drawing up a controversial national energy plan last year. The General Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, has threatened to take the White House to court in the next few days to force the release of Cheney's contact list in what could be the highest profile court fight between Congress and administration since Watergate. U.S. Controller General David Walker, who heads the GAO, has said he would begin legal proceedings this week if the administration does not provide the information. Cheney's been pressed for months to explain how often he met officials from Enron and other energy companies and how influential they were in lobbying for tax breaks, looser government regulations, and new business opportunities, such as the opening of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to oil exploration. Several dozen administration officials are former Enron consultants or significant former stockholders. The president had close dealings with the company for at least a decade and was on first-name terms on now-ousted company chair Kenneth Lay. Kenneth Lay was one of his chief campaign advisors. And actor James Woods has added his voice to the growing anti-Arab chorus in this country, letting loose a slew of racially charged epithets in a recent radio interview. Woods made the comment while he was promoting his upcoming movie, John Q, on KTLA-TV in Los Angeles. Woods declared, "Eventually one of these terrorist diaperheads is going to come around and do something more horrible. There's only one way to stop a terrorist, cut his head off."
In October 1993, a nation watched the unthinkable happen.
We're hit!
6-1 is going down.
Now, witness the courage.
Get him out of there.
RPG!
The world never saw.
Where do you think you're going?
For you guys, not that cast on your nut.
Don't let that man crawl!
Black Hawk Down. Rated R.
That's a trailer for Black Hawk Down. It's now number one on the blockbuster movie list. The New York Times is reporting the majority of Americans support expanding the so-called war on terror to Somalia. According to the latest New York Times CBS News poll, more than 80% of the country favors operations in alleged al-Qaeda hideouts, even if those countries refuse to assist. You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. It's wonderful to be back on all the Pacifica stations, and especially today at 9 o'clock on KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Amy Goodman. At the same time, the Hollywood war epic Black Hawk Down tops the box office charts for the second week in a row. Black Hawk Down says it tells the true story of the last U.S. invasion of Somalia in 1993, a mission the Clinton administration presented as humanitarian, designed to liberate thousands of starving Somalis from a brutal clan leader who was blocking U.N. food shipments and massacring U.N. workers. But when U.S. forces dropped into a teeming market in Mogadishu on October 3, 1993, 18 U.S. soldiers and over 1,000 Somalis were killed. President Clinton called the massacre one of the darkest hours of his administration. But former Disney studio chief Joe Roth, whose Revolution Studios made the $120 million movie, says his team would work to assure the audience that, quote, it is in fact America's brightest hour. So far, American audiences, both civilian and military, seem to be responding. But not everyone is pleased with the movie. In a number of cities, Somali American leaders and progressive activists have called for a boycott of Black Hawk Down. Today, we'll begin by going with Democracy Now! Producer Miranda Kennedy to a theater in New York's Union Square. She talked to various people about who were protesting outside about the movie.
Racism! Stop war!
Boycott Black Hawk Down!
Stop racism!
Stop war! Boycott Black Hawk Down!
The truth is, basically, this movie, we're upset because it portrays the Somalis as savage, as not having the same type of values that we have. In the movie, they portray that it was only the Americans that went back to get their dead and to stand up for their brothers who were involved in the situation. But actually, the Somalis did the same thing, okay? But that's blocked out of the movie. It was in the book, but they wouldn't put it in the movie.
And what do you think about the timing of the release of this film?
I think it's very convenient that it happens to come out right now at a time just when the name Somalia and Iraq is coming to the lips of the pundits, and now they're saying that that's where we're going next. Gee, how coincidental that that's when this movie comes out.
Hi, my name is Eric Anders Nilsson.
And tell me what your sign says.
It says Screen Actors Guild member against racism, war, and union bashing. And Ridley Scott has a very good history of union bashing. 2 years ago, during the SAG strike, he took out a full-page ad in a trade paper, and it depicted an African woman's breasts, and it said, shoot with us in South Africa. That's where his new studio was going to be during the strike. Shoot with us in South Africa, and this will be the only meaning of SAG. SAG meaning the woman's breast. It's a very offensive ad. Screen Actors Guild SAG protested against that ad 2 years ago, and I'm protesting against Ridley Scott again now. Very offensive. I saw this film. I know people are calling for a boycott. I believe in seeing what I'm boycotting, and I do see films for free. So I saw this film, and it's absolutely appalling. At the end of the film, there's an epilogue, and it says 1,000 Somalis were killed and 19 American soldiers. And then it lists the names of the American soldiers. What about the 1,000? I believe it's more. But what about the 1,000 Somalis? It was just a blur, just a number.
Is anyone else in the Screen Actors Guild joining you in boycotting this film?
I don't know. But, you know, I believe in the power of one. And I'm one person, and I'm sure there are many SAG actors who feel the same way I do. They may be afraid of speaking out. Maybe they're afraid they won't get a job. Some things are bigger than my career, and stomping out racism is one of those things.
You don't want to tell us your name because you are a Somali citizen? Okay, tell me, you were there at the time when this film was set, is that right?
I was there actually when problem was going on in Somalia, and I just got me here recently. But the way it is now, why they didn't show the film now is almost 10 years ago. Now they try to show the Somali people they are cruel people. They cannot live with anybody else or with any stranger. They cannot allow anything. They want to show that. So they want to wake up the American people to allow them to go back to Somalia to make another war. That's the only meaning of this war.
Well, we wanted to protest this racist depiction of the Somali people, as well as to expose the fact that the U.S. is using this type of movie, along with other movies that are coming out, like Collateral Damage, which Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is going to like depict the people of Colombia as, you know, in a dehumanizing way. This is all meant to whip up a war hysteria amongst the people of this country, to gear them up for the expansion of war that Bush has been talking about ever since September 11th. And this is a very, very dangerous piece of war propaganda. You don't have to go to a movie like Black Hawk Down to understand what this type of film, what it represents. You know, Hollywood has a sordid history of this type of propaganda, whether it's Birth of a Nation or Gone with the Wind or some other racist piece of film that is meant to dehumanize people and to demonize them and making people think that, well, these are our enemies, when really the enemies of the people of this country are those that are coming to the World Economic Forum on February 1st and 2nd. 1,000 billionaires, the richest representatives of corporations in the world, are going to be meeting at the Waldorf Astoria, plotting our future.
Just some of the people who participated in a protest calling for a boycott of Black Hawk Down. This was at Union Square in New York City. A few weeks ago, just as the movie was coming out, I had a chance to speak with the author of the book, Black Hawk Down. He is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Mark Bowden.
The movie tells the story, I think, very movingly, through the eyes of the soldiers who took part. And I do think it's kind of poignant, the contrast between, you know, the incredible courage and sacrifice that they made and then the broader public perception that they had failed and that this was somehow shameful and a disaster.
Mark Bowden, what was the involvement with the Pentagon with the making of this film?
The Pentagon cooperated with it. They provided Black Hawk helicopters and AH-6 Little Bird helicopters, which were the same equipment used in the assault. The helicopters were flown by pilots from the 160th SOAR Regiment, which is the helicopter unit that flew the helicopters during the assault in Somalia. In some cases, the same pilots were flying helicopters in the movie who flew them in the battle. And they also provided a group of rangers from Fort Benning who did a lot of the stunt work, the roping from the helicopters and other things. And again, in some instances, the soldiers who took part in the making of the film were some of the same people who took part in the battle.
And they were flown to Morocco to do this?
They were. They were flown to Morocco, and they stayed for several weeks. I spent a lot of time with them when we were over there, and they were thrilled to be a part of it. In some cases, it was eerie or surreal, I think, for individual soldiers who have, you know, very traumatic memories of that battle, who lost some of their best friends and in the middle of it, and in some cases were injured themselves. And so to be there reenacting it on a huge Hollywood set with a cast of thousands is, well, it's certainly something that they never anticipated would happen.
Presumably the Pentagon must have looked at the script to decide whether they wanted to participate in it.
That's correct, yep.
Did you work with them, and did the subsequent screenwriters work with them on the script?
Yes. The Pentagon, in order to secure that level of cooperation, would insist upon script approval. And was involved. They had a representative on the set, in addition to the technical advisors that we had on the set, two of the commanders from the units involved who were hired by the production company to provide technical advice. So there was no shortage of military people around while we made this movie.
Did they make changes to the script, the Pentagon?
They did. You know, there was a healthy, creative process, I think, where, you know, the Army would object to certain characterizations or lines of dialogue, mostly, I think, in an effort to present the military authentically. I didn't see a lot of propaganda, if that's the right word. I didn't see them making efforts to sort of clean up the story or alter the details of the story, because it's pretty well documented in the book, Black Hawk Down. but they were interested in making sure that things were shown accurately. I'll give you one example. There's a scene. There was a scene that was shot initially where an army captain, in trying to focus a young soldier who's been injured, slaps him in the face. And there were objections from the army advisors that that a captain would never treat a wounded man in that way. And they were so adamant about it. And in fact, there was no evidence from the battle itself that anything like that had ever happened. It was subsequently dropped from the scene.
Did the film hire any Somali consultants?
Yes. Well, in fact, there are probably more Somalis in this movie than any movie in history. Most of the extras in the film who play roles are Somalis. I don't know that they hired anyone to be on the set strictly to advise about Somalis.
As a journalist, do you have any problem with the Pentagon helping to shape the story?
Not at all. I would never let them help shape my story because what I write is journalism and it's documentary, and I think you know my objectivity and freedom to present information is critical. But I think on a feature film, which is by definition a slight fictionalization of events, it's based on an actual event. It's not presented as a documentary or as journalism. And because of the scale of it, the need to have, for authenticity's sake, the cooperation of the Pentagon, I think it is provided that they aren't insisting upon such changes that it would really significantly alter the truth of the story being told, which they didn't do, I think it's a reasonable compromise. For
Mark Bowden, he is the author of Black Hawk Down, and the movie is number one on the movie hits of this week and last. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Professor Claudia Carr and a leading Somali activist who's called for a boycott of the movie. Stay with us.
On the wings of a snow-white dove, he sends his pure, sweet love. A sign from above,
a sign from above.
On the wings of a dove, when trouble surrounds us, when the evils come, the body grows weak, the spirit grows numb. When these things beset us, he doesn't forget us.
He sends down his love,
he sends down his love.
On the wings of a dove, on the wings of a snow-white dove, he sends his pure, sweet.
Nancy Griffith, Wings of a Dove, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. And as we're back on in Hollywood and the Los Angeles area at 9 o'clock, it's wonderful to be back. Today we're taking on Hollywood, Black Hawk Down, and the boycott that's been proposed against it. I'm Amy Goodman, joined on the telephone right now by Claudia Carr, an activist and one of the leading scholars on Somalia. She's at the University of California, Berkeley, and Omar Jamal, director of Somali Justice Advocacy Network in St. Paul, Minnesota. Let's begin with you, Omar Jamal. Why are you calling for a boycott of this number one film, Black Hawk Down?
Well, one of the first reasons actually we are doing this is that because the movie claims to be based on a true story that happened October the 3rd, 1993, in the city of Mogadishu City. Actually, after watching the movie with some of the Somalis who were there at the time, it's not completely even close to the story that actually happened. And therefore, we then started questioning the purpose of this movie. And even the book it claims that it's based on, Black Hawk Down by Mark Bowden, it's not even has not have the same theme and plot or the line that the movie is supposed to be based on. So then we started actually questioning the purpose of this movie, and it's very sad. We live in a world today where foreign policies are based on the manipulation and twist of these stories of Hollywood, where in hope to find the collective consent of the American citizens in order to achieve political objectives. So we seriously questioned the purpose, and it was very sad, the betrayal of the movie. And of course, if you look at from the American perspective, the movie is heroic, gallantry. One may as well say that it's a good movie, and I may not have much problem with that. But if it claims that it's based on true story where Somalis were involved, that's not the story.
You know, it's interesting that I bet if a poll were done in the United States of people asking what happened on that day when 100 special forces and Delta forces soldiers were dropped into the teeming market of Mogadishu, most people would remember the image of the U.S. soldier who was dragged through the streets, and that 18 soldiers did die. But very few people in this country understand that 1,000 Somalis died on that day.
Well, actually, there were more than 1,000, actually more than 5,000, most of whom were civilians who were killed. And one thing we have to keep in mind is the movie is based on one incident out of seven attempts that the Rangers and Delta Force tried to catch the warlord. It was not the first time the Rangers descended into ropes from helicopter in one of the buildings in Mogadishu. They attempted seven times, each of which Somalis took casualties. Most of them were civilians. And the movie is based only one war where Americans took like 18 Marines died, and they ignored out of the other six war. And which is very sad, and it somewhat makes the tragic moment, both to Americans and the Somalis, very belittling. And the fact that there were 5,000 Somalis casualties, they said 1,000, and that's really very sad.
President Clinton called the massacre in Somalia one of the darkest hours of his administration. Former Disney studio chief Joe Rotho, whose Revolution Studios made the $120 million blockbuster movie, said that the movie would show that it was, in fact, America's brightest hour. I wanted to ask Omar Jamal if you would turn down the TV or radio in the background, but Claudia Carr, you have lived in Somalia for years, studied U.S. policy in the region. We have had you on several times in the war in Afghanistan, talking about oil interests in the region. But can you talk about the representation of Black Hawk Down? You heard Mark Bowden saying, well, the movie, of course, is just a sort of fictionalized account, though clearly very real with all the names of the soldiers there of the same, that it's a Hollywood account of what happened.
Absolutely. It's very nice to be with you today, Amy. Certainly nobody has any argument, I don't think, with this film as a portrayal of the risks and the camaraderie and the destruction and so forth involving U.S. forces. That part is clear. In that regard, I would certainly say Mark Bowden's story is really the same story as the Pentagon's story, whether he intended it or not. But for, obviously, most Somalis, I didn't get to hear Omar a moment ago, but certainly the Somalis who I am familiar with, and that's many around here and in Somalia itself, and Amy, certainly workers like myself who I think have been there and lived in villages and been with Somalis and other people in the Horn in the refugee camps and worked with people in the government in the past and with aid groups and so forth, are extremely disturbed by what appears to be a marketing of patriotism, really, to some real extent. And I think they immediately are disturbed along some particular lines. This film is a gross distortion, certainly, of issues starting with what caused this crisis and what was the U.S. doing there in the first place. This film definitely takes a position, not just implicitly, that the U.S. simply dropped in on October 3rd, 1993. In point of fact, the U.S. dropped in to dominate the entire nation 17 years earlier. And that's a very critical thing that we might just very briefly talk about. But I wanted to suggest, Amy, there's some clues, important clues, that should raise some disturbing questions for us. And they're just the simplest questions that we might raise, it just to do a couple. Number one, why did the, if we were just dropping in at that point, we, the U.S., why did the U.S. drop in when the famine was at its worst? Certainly well over a year prior to that, over 25% of all the kids or children in Somalia under 5 years old were dead by the time this happened. So that raises some questions about what was the actual motive. Another one, why did Somalia have what I believe is the largest embassy in all of Africa, $35 million embassy with golf courses and tennis courts and so forth. And that raises some questions about if the U.S. had been there for 17 years, which in point of fact they had, and with an embassy they were just building that size, there must have been some other interest. Third one, why did the Marines land, in fact, on the beaches considerably earlier than Black Hawk Down? They landed in December 92. They also had a landing that was coordinated out of Conoco Oil Corporation headquarters. That raises some questions. And then the last one, as a clue, what about this Mohammed Aidid, where we see in the introduction in the film that he was absolutely identified as the villain, and the reason that the U.S. dropped in, wrongly identified, obviously. Why is it, we might ask, that Mohammed Aidid was just like Noriega, just like Saddam Hussein, like the Taliban, and in fact bin Laden himself, a friend of the U.S., and then all of a sudden, very, very abruptly, becomes the ultimate villain. So I think these are just some of the clues that make us really want to go back and say, but what really had been going on in those 17 years? And why possibly would people in Somalia, like so many other countries, not like us? And I think the real answers to that may have to do with the history of U.S. involvement in the country.
It's interesting, when we've spoken to you before, Professor Claudia Carr, you describe how the FBI raided your offices recently. Can you talk about why they would have an interest in doing that? Are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. That actually was, in that case, unrelated, Amy, but I think it had to do with Central Asia, not really Somalia. But I will say that for people who work in this area, it's very common that there's so much overlap, and you have to learn to deal with people from the CIA, from the military, from executives from corporations and so forth, from the World Bank, the International Finance Corporation, and it's a very incestuous world. And so one does expect certain things. I, more to the point from this area, Amy, this was not unusual. I don't think I had a book manuscript stolen by the CIA from Washington, D.C. It was on this area, the gas-producing area right next door in Ethiopia. And when the CIA contacted me, saying, we think we can get your book manuscript back, I was told that I should be coming anyway for some seminars. I declined politely to get those seminars, but I never did see my book manuscript again. The punchline of that one, Amy, is when I was quite upset about the whole thing, it represented a lot of work of mine. I went to the Somalia desk and Ethiopia desk at the State Department, and the head of the desk said, well, Claudia, I have these things happen all the time. The CIA comes in my apartment, etc. So that is the way the game is played. It's an information game, of course. I think when we look at why the U.S. was in Somalia, running it, basically, for 17 years, we get answers to that. What kind of information do they want? Amy, and I think this is a key place throughout the entire Cold War. It's been a key place to monitor all the oil coming down the Red Sea, which is most of the oil of the world, between that and coming out of the Persian Gulf.
What about the issue of Black Hawk Down being rushed to the screen? It was supposed to be released in something like March. It was moved up to December, right around the time that news was coming out of top-level U.S. Figures, political figures, going to Somalia to find targets as the Bush administration expands the war on terrorism, the so-called war on terrorism.
Well, I think that's something many of us have been certainly thinking about, and there have been lots of informal talking about, and obviously publicized meetings right after 9/11, publicized meetings between Hollywood and the Pentagon, with Hollywood saying very openly in the media, what can we do? For you, the Pentagon. So I would simply make a direct statement of it's obviously not only adaptive, it certainly feeds what I suppose we should be seeing now as an opportunity for the U.S. to go back into Somalia, but the question is why? Is it really to find the Al-Qaeda? Are there any Al-Qaeda? Those of us who live there, I don't think anybody would say there's what is a terrorist. There's no terrorist anywhere in Somalia, but certainly the concerns of 99.9% of the people there have to do with finding grass and browse for the few animals they have and finding some water and so forth. So I think finding the opportunity to go in there doesn't probably have much to do with terrorism. I personally think, and I think many of my colleagues feel, it has to do with restabilizing, making an entree again to Somalia, this very important part of the world. And certainly U.S. oil interests are extremely important there. And there are many oil corporations that have expressed very direct statements, as they did in 1993 in March, that they are ready to resume work in these massive exploration of massive oil reserves equal to about Kazakhstan, and really huge gas reserves in the region as well, equal to about the North Sea. So this has been very important. I might just add, Amy, that I believe going back into Somalia now is something that is certainly attractive to the U.S., but if we can get back to the Somalis and to the people, I think, who have very strong experience in that area, that means going back into an area where people experienced the United States supporting a dictator for 17 years who committed massive human rights abuses, executions, and literally massacres, and maybe 50,000 people killed in just the northern region of Somalia alone, with tremendous hunger and corruption, really very incestuous relationship between U.S. foreign policy, the military, corporate interests increasingly, and that dictatorship. We might finish that on Mohammed Aidid himself, because the fact of the matter is, by 1990, 1991, the opposition to Siad Barre, the dictator supported by the U.S., was so extreme. And Mohammed Aidid, now our villain we've identified in the film, was actually a hero to the Somalis, which I think makes us reflect about why some of the feeling we see in the film, or at least portrayed. I did two things. He was a hero for helping getting rid of Siad Barre. He then, I think, was considered a friend of the U.S., and by the way, his son was a Marine in the U.S. Marine Corps. His wife lived in Los Angeles, so he was truly seen as an ally by many people in the U.S. But he began questioning the oil leases that had been signed, huge U.S. Corporate oil leases. And he was, without any question, the most nationalistic of the so-called warlords. So at this point, I think the U.S. really reversed its policy and decided he was going to be the next target, and this made it really possible to move into Somalia. I think we see these same kinds of processes now, you know, going in. We have to have new devils. But stabilizing and going in for resources and so forth are certainly on the agenda.
Well, Claudia Carr, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Claudia Carr, activist and one of the leading scholars on Somalia-U.S. relations. Omar Jamal, director of the Somali Justice Advocacy Network in St. Paul, Minnesota. At times like this, it's clear we need a Somaliwood, as Hollywood tells a very different story of what happened on October 3rd, 1993. 18 U.S. soldiers died. More than 1,000, Omar Jamal says, perhaps more than 5,000 Somalis died in that just over 24-hour period. You are listening to Democracy Now! We're going to break early for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to look at the crackdown on dissent in college campuses in the United States, specifically one place today, and that's Columbia, as New York City gears up for the World Economic Forum of hundreds of the world's top business leaders coming to town. Columbia University students tried to hold a counter-summit. We'll hear about the administration's response, and then we'll look at the education bill that was recently passed into law. Stay with us.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. You preach a man, don't tell me. Heaven is under the earth. You are dopey and you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I am Amy Goodman. After September 11th, a number of students and professors around the country reported that it was becoming increasingly difficult to hold forums that were critical of U.S. policy. This week, leading up to the World Economic Forum in New York, where hundreds of the world's top business leaders and powerful politicians who shape the global agenda will be in New York at the Waldorf Astoria, students at Columbia University, a group called Students for Global Justice, attempted to put together a counter summit. And it looks like it is going to take place, but not without some resistance from the Columbia University administration. Yvonne Liu is with us. Tell us what happened at Columbia. Yvonne Liu is a student at Columbia University.
Right. About 2 weeks ago, most of our events were going to be taking place at Barnard College, and about 2 weeks ago, the provost at Barnard College had met with the director of the Women's Center at Barnard College, who was influential in getting a lot of the space that we had. And the result of the meeting was that the 15 classrooms that we had set aside for the conference were taken away from us. We had a lot of restrictions placed on us. We only had 4 classrooms as a result of that meeting at Barnard. People had to wear badges at all times when they were at the conference, and also the list of the people that were in each room had to be, we had to maintain a list with all the names of the people in each room, and that list had to be available to both Columbia and Barnard administration and security.
The list before the students came had to be, the students had to be put on a list?
Actually, every person that's in a room at any time on campus would have to put their name onto a list, which would be available to both security and administration. And this was 2 weeks before the conference actually happened. So last week, we successfully had a meeting with Columbia administration, and we were able to get space at Columbia. The space at Barnard was never returned to us. We were planning to have registration at Barnard as well, and none of that came through. And it was confirmed for us that that space isn't being used for classes or anything else. It's just sitting there right now.
You had to bring the New York Civil Liberties Union into this case.
That's right. We had a really successful meeting with the Columbia administration where Norman Siegel of the NYCLU and also Diedrich Mohammed of the National Action Network came to voice their support for us, and that very helped us a lot.
So you are going to hold the counter summit?
Yeah, we are. And it's going to mainly be at Columbia right now because we were successful in lobbying to get space at Columbia. So,
and the reason you're holding the summit?
Well, we want to the main goal for Students for Global Justice, we're actually a national collective. We're not based just at Columbia University. We just started this past mid-December just to mobilize specifically for this action. And our main goals is to educate and activate both students and activists on issues like global equity, development, and sustainability. So our main goals with this counter summit is to bring to light issues that the World Economic Forum has. We're going to be having 2 plenaries at our conference. One is on globalization, militarism, the neoliberal agenda, and its discontents, where we'll have people from the Rainforest Action Network, Manning Marable from Columbia University, speak on the different ramifications of globalization and the neoliberal agenda on the world, on the environment, on public health, on women and children. And we're also having a second plenary, which is going to be called Another World is Possible, sort of in tune with the local coalition in New York, which people will present positive and proactive visions on how we can actually create another world. And we're going to have speakers from Starhawk, for example, Barbara Garson, different speakers speak to that.
Well, we're going to be covering the events this week in New York as well. Deepa Fernandez, Democracy Now! Producer, and Chris Abrams as well will be in Porto Alegre in Brazil for the World Social Forum. So we'll be on the streets in New York at the Counter Summit, at the World Economic Forum, as well as the World Social Forum, where tens of thousands of people from around the world are gathering to talk about the issue of alternatives. And I want to thank you very much for being with us, Yvonne Liu of Columbia.
I just wanted to announce our website, which is studentsforglobaljustice.org. And we have a wealth of information on there, as well as a schedule of events that will be happening this week, including the Day of Action Foundation, which is going to be February 2nd, a festival of organized resistance that we're having in the evening of February 2nd, the same time that the WEF is having their evening gala on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange.
And people can go to our website and also get those contacts at democracynow.org. Thanks, Yvonne. Well, we're going to continue on the issue of education. Vice President Dick Cheney announced yesterday that the White House is prepared to go to court to fight the release of documents demanded by Congress as part of the investigation into the Enron scandal. But the head of the General Accounting Office disagrees and has vowed to file suit if the White House does not hand over the documents by the end of the week. Meanwhile, with eyes fixed on Enron, the nation has ignored what's perhaps the latest victory for crony politics. On January 8th, the president signed into law the Secondary Education Act. It is the most ambitious federal overhaul of the public school system since the 1960s. The Education Act has been hailed by the mainstream media as a bipartisan triumph. The bill received the full support of Senators Edward Kennedy and Paul Wellstone, and when it came up for a vote in mid-December, both the House and Senate voted overwhelmingly in its favor. But for all the bipartisan photo opportunities and the cross-aisle handshakes, make no mistake, the Education Act of 2002 is a huge victory for Bush. The Education Act, commonly known as the Leave No Child Behind Act, takes its cues from the Texas model of school reform. States will now test all students annually from 3rd to 8th grade while launching a federally guided drive for universal literacy among school children. Perhaps more strikingly, a political party that once called for the abolition of the Education Department has radically enhanced the federal presence in public schools. After repeating the mantra of local control and states' rights for a generation, the GOP now intrudes on both. So what happened? Well, the answer is not a simple one, but the answer begins, much like the Enron scandal, with old boy friendships, fuzzy theory, and big business. There's a very interesting piece in the Nation magazine about the issue of the Education Act. But today we are going to go to Gerald Coles, an education psychologist who's written extensively on literacy and learning disabilities. Can you talk about the corporate underpinning of this bill?
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
It's great to be here. There are many portions of the education bill, the ones that are the core of the bill and the ones that will damage children's education at the same time that corporations like McGraw-Hill profit from this damage are the reading education portion and the test education portion. The key to the reading education portion is a phrase called scientifically based reading instruction, which is a phrase that's used approximately 50 times in the Bush education legislation. What it means in brief is that it's an education that emphasizes skills, emphasizes a strong managerial control over education, goes first from sounds to children learning the connection of letters to sounds, to identifying words rapidly and eventually getting to comprehension, although it's a comprehension, it's comprehension light. The embodiment of this so-called scientifically based reading education is found in various commercial programs, the leading program of which, leading programs, are manufactured by McGraw-Hill. The leading program among these programs is a program called Open Court. The McGraw-Hill is profits from this education bill, not only by publishing the literacy programs, but also being the leading publisher of tests K through 12. So the Bush education legislation, which mandates testing of children from grades 3 to 8, then represents a bonanza for McGraw-Hill. The third part of McGraw-Hill that will profit from this is a part called School Evaluation Services, which is a subdivision of Standard & Poor's, the stock rating company, which McGraw-Hill also owns. And it's this company that will make a lot of money by crunching the numbers that the tests produce. Years ago, former chairman of General Motors, Charlie Wilson, said, what's good for General Motors is good for the country. So we can ask the same question here. McGraw-Hill has made and will continue to make millions on these educational programs and testing, but is it good for children? So they're making millions, but maybe children's education will be advanced nonetheless. Well, the answer to this is an unqualified no, for several reasons. The leading one is that there is no such thing as scientifically based reading education. There certainly is science on behalf of different that can be mustered on behalf of different kind of instructional programs, but the phrase is a sham that that pretends to create the illusion of an apolitical scientific objectivity that's ascribed to one kind of instruction over others. And it just happens that McGraw-Hill's products embody this the most. If you look at the basic research on the so-called education, you find that it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. My book, Misreading Reading, goes through this entire body of research and finds that that it fails to justify its claims. To give you one quick example of this, there's been study after study that's emphasized skills education in early reading education, but when you test children in second and third grade, you find that these skills have no carryover to comprehension. So we're about to embark on a heavy-duty instructional mandate that's going to emphasize skills, and the outcome of it is going to be very poor comprehension abilities on the part of the children who were forced to undergo this.
We're talking to Gerald Coles, who is an educational psychologist, written extensively on literacy and learning disabilities, wrote the book Reading Lessons, The Debate Over Literacy and Misreading Reading, The Bad Science That Hurts Children, talking about McGraw-Hill and the Nation Peace, Reading Between the Lines, the New Education Laws, a Victory for Bush and for his corporate allies, talks extensively about Harold McGraw and about the education summit that George Bush held, a guest list dominated by Fortune 500 CEOs like Harold McGraw, the publishing scion and current chair of McGraw-Hill, who summed up, quote, "It's a great day for education because we now have substantial alignment among all the key constituents, the public, the education community, business, and political leaders, that results matter." This is a person who has extensive links to the Bush administration. Harold McGraw sits on the National Grant Advisory and founding board of the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy, in turn received the highest literacy award from President Bush in the early 1990s for contributions to the cause of literacy. And the McGraw Foundation awarded current Bush Education Secretary Rod Paige its highest educator's award, while Paige was Houston's school chief. Paige, in turn, was the keynote speaker at McGraw-Hill's Government Initiatives Conference last spring. And it goes on from there, talking about the various McGraw family members. We're also joined in the studio by Bill Wetzel, who is founder of Students Against Testing. The part of the bill that deals with testing, what's your evaluation of that, and why are you so opposed to these standardized tests?
Well, what we've been seeing with this bill, specifically that it mandates testing grades 3 through 8, is that this is just a continuation of what's already been really happening in the last 5 to 10 years. Schools across the country are being turned to test prep factories. Critical thinking is leaving. Any kind of real discussion is leaving. And more of these schools now on a national basis are going to force to become centers of spoon feeding instead of trying to be centers of learning.
On the issue of the tests, if people don't take standardized tests, can they, for example, get into college?
Well, certain alternative schools, particularly in New York City and around the country, are developing models where there's much more richer and diverse ways of proving students' skills and that they can learn without just filling in bubbles. Students can demonstrate their skills through a wide variety of portfolios, alternative assessments, and real-life projects that they've done instead of just every student in the country being a score on a spreadsheet. And I think it's colleges more and more who are realizing that they too need to see students as more than test scores.
Bill, you were a teacher at one of these, what you call test factories. Can you describe your experience? Where were you teaching?
I was teaching at an inner city high school down in Durham, North Carolina. And basically for about 2 to 3 months in the spring, the school just simply aligned itself to, quote, rocking the EOGs. That's the test there. I was teaching high schoolers. And I was a substitute in these classes, and I was doing all I could to bring thinking, bring discussions into the classes. And I would be faced with lesson plans from the teachers just wanting to go through test prep booklets, no doubt most likely published by McGraw-Hill day in and day out. And towards the end of the year, I was actually fired when me and the students tried to develop an independent study program in the school where students could develop their own curriculums and work with me one-on-one to go with their projects.
Let me end with Gerald Coles. Where do education activists go from here with the education bill passed?
Well, I think the first thing that that people have to do, educational activists and the public generally, is to understand what is the real meaning of this of the educational bill and the Bush educational program. What we have is Bush's supposed signature issue of his national agenda, which is going to turn out to be one of the catastrophes of the administration. So I think it's important for people and activists, public and activists included, to understand what the heart of this is, if the term heart can be used, and be able to base activism upon that knowledge. Unfortunately, I'm emphasizing this because it's very hard to encourage people to become activists against this if there's virtually no information about what the truth of the matter is, which is when, and the truth of the matter has been cloaked quite successfully by the major media.
Bill Wetzel, you're going to be holding a protest outside of McGraw-Hill tomorrow in New York City.
Yes, it's going to be at 5:30 at the New York Public Library, and we're going to be gathering at the McGraw-Hill Education Awards Banquet, which is an annual gala held by McGraw-Hill where they honor their sort of allies in their testing corporation. Just for an example, last year they gave the award to Rod Page and the CEO of Citigroup as well, and these are the people who they claim are having a great commitment to education when they're actually just boosting McGraw-Hill's payroll. So we're going to be out there tell them that we want learning, not testing, in our schools.
If I could just make one comment about McGraw, about Rod Page and the award. There was a study that was released last year on high school dropouts, and Houston schools under Rod Page had the seventh highest dropout rate in the country. We can only imagine why Rod Page got this Educator of the Year award from McGraw-Hill. It certainly wasn't because of students' academic success in the school district.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Gerard Coles, your email address, gscoles@igc.org. That's G-S-C-O-L-E-S at igc.org. And Bill Wetzel, your website?
It's www.nomoretests.com.
Thanks for being with us. You have I've been listening to Democracy Now!, and Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Go to our website at democracynow.org. We are broadcasting from Downtown Community Television, thanks to Manhattan Neighborhood Network. It is wonderful to be back on all of the Pacifica stations today at 9 a.m. in the morning, and the Pacifica affiliates on public access TV stations and Dish Network, channel 9415. For Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition.